Isn't it refreshing when someone further down the path is actually willing to share the successes and failures they've seen along the way? That's exactly the type of conversation you're going to get from today's episode with Eric Hsu, CEO of Single Grain, founder of Leveling Up, and co-host alongside his friend Neil Patel of the Top Ranked Marketing School podcast. Eric's journey has taken him from having, quote unquote, no idea how to run a business at 27 to now having scaled his agency into eight figures, all while building a media brand, authoring a book, and becoming a recognizable name in SEO and modern marketing. Despite all of this success, Eric doesn't hold back from sharing his missteps along the way, and most importantly, the lessons you can take from them. In this episode, you'll hear what roles should be contractors versus full-time employees in your agency, the CEO's actual role in hiring during times of growth, and counterintuitive ways to identify and recruit new talent. In addition to sharing his hard-learned hiring secrets, Eric also shares the two best operating systems you can steal from to make your agency run more smoothly, and when and where pay-for-performance pricing makes sense for most agencies. To kick things off, let's hear Eric's response to my question about the most pivotal moment in his journey as an agency owner and a hiring decision that took a terrible turn.
You hear all the sexiness about going out there and hiring a CEO and hiring a GM to replace you so you can go do other things. And it sounds very nice in principle. Maybe give them 5, 10, 15, 20% of the business or give them a profit share, whatever it is exactly. But the idea about it sounds nice, but thinking that you can have someone, you can outsource your thinking and outsource the thing that you're most incentivized to grow to someone else is naive. And I learned that the hard way. And so, you know, we did these two acquisitions in 2021. And one thing that happened, I had already hired a couple, like three GM/CEOs that didn't work out. And this was the fourth one, right? And this person came from a lot of agency experience. And what ended up happening was, you know, we'll just say that this person was dishonest and they poached a client of ours that was paying us maybe $2 million a year. So maybe $1 or $2 million, something like that. But they had also told other employees that, you know, leadership hates them and that, you know, we're doing all these things with the company that just weren't true. So they're spreading a lot of misinformation. And what happened was that this individual moved on to another agency while they're still employed by us. We put this person on paid leave and said, you know, go take care of your family situation. Cause we're like, we care about this person, right? This person went to another agency, brought a couple of Single Grain employees with them, and then tried to do the same exact thing to the other agency, right? So all this to say is that, you know, that's because I trusted, but I didn't verify. So just make sure that, you know, if you're going to hire amazing, like, yes, always hire amazing people, but what you can't abdicate is your responsibility to stay involved and grow the thing. Whether you're a chairman or you're a CEO, you should stay involved, and that's how you're going to grow the thing. That's probably one of my biggest lessons.
Oh man, what a story there. I can just imagine, you know, going through that process and like you said, realizing, oh, we've got something here, but hey, we're going to give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe, you know, something weird's going on here. And not only, you know, did it get worse, but it was doubled down on it got worse for you. And then the next agency. And would you say that trust but verify was kind of the key thing that you learned from that?
Yes, absolutely. Trust but verify. And that carried over into multiple areas, right? Like I'm a little, you know, you can see it's an honorable thing for me to want to see people grow to reach their potential. Cause my whole thesis is if I can figure it out, anybody can figure it out, right? And that's not actually true. More times often than not, that's not true. And so we had a very nice person that was handling recruiting, and I kind of just let it sit to the side. And we started recruiting all these people that just weren't the right fit. And at the end of the day, the only person I can blame is not that person, but I can only blame myself. So trust but verify is huge.
And taking that ultimate ownership that you can't, like you said a few minutes ago, you can, it's a superpower of an agency owner to be able to delegate, to be able to scale up. You have to be able to do that, but that doesn't mean that you abdicate the responsibility, right? Just like a good coach who has to face that bad post-game presser after a loss. And I think this idea of training up and trusting but verifying the people that you add to your team segues really nicely into the three areas I wanted to pick your brain on as you have reached some successes in your journey as an agency founder. So we've got people, process, and pricing. Really all three you've got to get right in some form or fashion, at least decently well, if you're going to have any hope of scaling your agency. When it comes to people and hiring, one of the things I've seen in your content before, Eric, is that you have this point of view that oftentimes agencies think that they can scale with contractors maybe a little bit more than they should. And you've leaned into really full-time employees more so. What has developed your thinking on that, and has it changed over the years?
Yeah. So I would say when it comes to hiring talent, I believe that strategic talent should be onshore. So onshore for me is United States. And I believe if it's executional creative talent, then let's say for design or maybe even development, you can get away with offshore. You can get away with nearshore as well, which is like for us, it's LATAM. And that's worked out really well for us. So for example, my brand team that helps with the podcast and a lot of the editing, they're great. They're based in the Philippines. And then that brand team meeting happens on Mondays at 5 p.m. Pacific, right? Because that's 8 a.m. their time. So it actually ends up working out, and they're great to work with. They're a pleasure. But we do know that we unfortunately can't put these people in front of clients, because clients will be like, okay, they'll start to complain about, oh, we want someone in the Americas. Oh, we want, like, you know, when it comes to strategy, like usually people onshore are better at that. So what we found to be a good mix of is strategists, you know, onshore. Maybe we might have some people doing execution onshore. And then we can, you know, we can take a look offshore, nearshore for more creative talent.
That makes a lot of sense. As opposed to, you know, as much as a hot take of always have FTEs or you can scale 100% by offshoring everything, there's a middle ground there. But it's a pretty easy framework, I think, for other agency owners to digest and take away from this conversation. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, when you're looking to add those full-time employees for the more strategic roles, kind of a misstep oftentimes that agency owners and, you know, maybe their people teams get wrong is researching accomplishments or just other names on the resume of the individual, as opposed to what's their tenure, what's their promotion history, those sorts of things. What are maybe some of the lessons learned, maybe hard learned lessons in hiring the right people, especially for those strategic roles as you scale your agency?
Yeah, I'll tell you one big mistake I made again was trusting but not verifying. And so when we're recruiting all these people, I actually was at the very end. So the leaders at the very end, you know, they go through all these, they jump through all these hoops. But by the time they make it to the very end, if I'm going to say no, I start to feel really bad, right? And that's, again, everything to blame is me at the end of the day. But it's like, oh, they met so many people. They're like, oh, can we please hire? Can we please hire? You almost feel like, you know, you're like being a mean parent or something. And so I feel this tremendous guilt, right? And so my whole thing now is, and when you look at like a Jeff Bezos or a DoorDash CEO or even like military generals, a lot of them, they're very involved with the hiring process. Some of them even earlier, right? And so my whole thing is, okay, if people's the most important thing, then I should get involved earlier, right? So that's one of the things I think that we do that other people don't. And so we can just say no very quickly. And by the way, if someone's not a fit, I'll just say, hey, Logan, unfortunately, you know, I appreciate the time, but I don't want to waste your time anymore. I don't think this is going to be a good fit. And you just end it right there, right? And so it saves everyone's time and we get to move faster. And plus we get to, if I think someone's like an F yes, we call them like a, if it's not an F yes, it's an F no, right? If it's an F yes, we move them on. We do these written assessments because it helps us figure out how people write and how people think, how they articulate their thoughts. And then, you know, we move them on to a panel interview, right? So the one tactical thing I can give to everyone here is, read a book called Working Backwards. This is a book written about Amazon. And so this one guy one of the co-authors was a chief of staff for Jeff Bezos for about 2 to 3 years. So he followed Jeff Bezos doing everything, right? And then the other guy helped found he helped with Kindle. And I think he helped with the digital division, you know, as they transitioned from books to become a much bigger company. The reason why I bring up that book is because their entire hiring framework is in there, right? Like they don't do reference checks. All they do is track values at each stage and they have someone that will verify. You know, they'll have like someone that's called a bar raiser. That person's going to check to see if, you know, if we're going to hire Logan, is Logan actually a bar raiser or are we cutting corners to try to just make do with this person, right? Because that's how agencies fall apart. They start to compromise on talent and then the bozo explosion begins where you have a bunch of B and C players.
The bozo explosion. That's a new one for me. And that's a book, Working Backwards, that we haven't heard here on the show yet. So we'll make sure to put that in the description. That's a really good shout out. How about this concept of a role scorecard over a job description that I've heard you talk about before? Where does that play into this and add to your thinking from the principles in Working Backwards as we were talking about?
Yeah. So there's two threads to pull on there. So one is Amazon has this culture of writing. And this is one of the things we implemented at our company where, let's say, Logan, you come with a new idea. The problem is, if you come with a new idea, maybe you've come with this PowerPoint, the thinking is more so delegated to the rest of the audience, right? And so they have a culture of writing narratives and memos. It might be like a 3-pager or a 6-pager or so, where it requires you to be very clear about what you're writing and what you want, what you desire, what the success metrics are, what the resources required are, what the potential ROI is. Now that it's more daunting to have to, there's work that's required to bring out your idea. Most people are just not going to bring, like, most people are going to think twice about bringing ideas. It's going to force clear thought. And we do that across the organization for different types of ideas. We do the same thing for roles as well. So typically, you know, someone might say, oh, Eric wants to hire something new. Oh, well, they'll just go to HR and say, hey, we need to hire this over here. And HR will be like, okay, I'm just going to go cut and paste or Frankenstein some job descriptions together and that's it. Well, no, because the HR person doesn't exactly know what they need. The hiring manager doesn't want to do the work. And so the role scorecard forces the hiring manager to write a scorecard about, okay, these are the main things that this person needs to accomplish in the next 90 days or the first 90 days of being here. So for example, let's say we're looking to hire a CEO. Okay, has this CEO managed like $100 million P&L or $1 billion P&L or something like that? Okay, grade them, A, B, C, D, F. And then it's like, okay, have they hired an executive team from scratch? A, B, C, D, F, okay? And so then you have like the main things that they're supposed to accomplish with very specific metrics. And then you have the responsibilities. Then you have like, are they a cultural fit? And then you just grade them on all these things, A, B, C, D, F, right? And then everyone compares notes afterwards. Only when the role scorecard is created can a job description then be created, because now people know what you're looking for. So the problem with most companies, not even just agencies, is most people just like to throw everything into HR, and then that leads to substandard hiring.
Yeah, I was first introduced to the idea of a role scorecard within an agency when we were starting to build a team and needing to do so really quickly. And we were kind of looking around of like, how do we do this hiring and recruiting thing? Like, what should we do? And that was so clarifying, as opposed to doing an interview, whether you're doing them sequential or you're doing some group ones, but not, I kind of liked them. I like this, I like that. And it's like, how do you compare all this? Right? Especially if you do have a crop of good talent that you are looking at and assessing. Do you guys still use the Principles U assessment in your process of adding people to the team at Single Grain? How does that play into the process?
When we send people the assessment, so we send them, we'll send them the written assessment, and then we'll also send them the personality test, which is Principles U. And that's the personality test that was created by Adam Grant and Ray Dalio. So Adam Grant, the psychologist, and then Ray Dalio, obviously the hedge fund manager. It's an amazing test because we feel that it's like 90 to 95% accurate. So for example, here's what it says about me. It says out of 100%, I'm 6% detail oriented, but I'm 87% dependable, which is completely true. If you start to talk a bunch of details, I'll just check out of the conversation. And it says like how creative I am. It says how reliable I am. It says how humble I am, how composed I can be. And it's accurate across the board. And so we can just look at someone and be like, okay, are they open-minded? Are they humble? Are they composed? If there's a lot of red flags and they don't do a good assessment, well, then we like to say the booby traps have worked and they fall through the booby trap and that they fall out of the process.
That's fantastic, man. What was the Bozo explosion and the booby traps worked? Some really good one-liners here when it comes to hiring and finding the right team members, because in an agency environment, as I always say, the people are the product, right? If you get the wrong people, clients are going to leave. If you bring in people that maybe aren't the right fit, and they leave, then client churn is really going to follow employee churn. And you can see that in other industries, but I think in a service-based firm, then that is that much more true. Another thing I've heard you talk about, Eric, is some interesting ways to source talent on social media, either by posting or by reaching out and engaging, asking for referrals. What is maybe some low-hanging fruit here for the agency owner who's just kind of getting started and building the team, and or they say, man, I've kind of delegated this too much. I need to jump back into it. Whichever scenario they're in, what are some of your pieces of advice there?
Yeah, I think if you're starting out, nothing beats the founder going out there and sourcing. So for example, if I'm looking to hire people that are podcast pros, I might reach out and just, you know, let's say the title is Podcast Pro and I search on LinkedIn Podcast Pro and then I find your name, Logan, right? So I'll reach out and say, hey, Logan, do you know of anyone that might be interested in a Podcast Pro role that we have at Single Grain, we're looking to hire? And more often than not, I mean, maybe 20% of the time people respond and say, hey, I'm actually interested. And sometimes they said, oh no, but I have this person that might be interested. Then we'll talk to that person. That goes a long way. Instead of saying, hey, like, are you looking for a job, right? That's more of a disarming way of asking. And it's only like two sentences. It's like very short. And then, you know, just the subject line might just be like, you know, the title and then role, like podcast pro role. That's it. And so that this is if you have no audience. Now, if you do have some semblance of an audience on LinkedIn or X or Twitter, whatever you want to call it, you would say, hey, you know, like, who are the best podcast pros that you know? Tag them in here. And if we make the hire, we'll give you, you know, $500, $1,000, $3,000 or something like that. The higher the incentive, the more people would just start tagging. And we made some hires through that, right? And so, you know, people just tag a bunch of people. And there's one guy that that were like an executive hire that we're still looking to make maybe in the next year or two. I've been talking to him for the last 2 years or so, and we're still looking at trying to figure out how we can do something. So, you know, that's another key thing. Like, once you find someone great, even though the timing's not right, you want to keep circling back with them every 90 days or so and just be like, hey, like, how are things going? Just text them, right? How are things going? It's like, what do you need right now? What can I be helpful with? And it's like, hey, like, I'm sure we'll find something to do eventually. So the fortune's in the follow-up, and people often forget that.
Oh, that's so good. Again, with people being really how you effectively scale the agency, getting the right people in, takes some nuanced approach. So I like that. Find people that fit the persona for the role that you're looking for. And instead of just headhunting them or making them feel like they're getting that, you know, smarmy LinkedIn message, Eric, we've got a franchise opportunity for you that you're not going to want to miss out, right? Just, hey, do you know anyone? So there's that one. Post and offer a reward, especially on LinkedIn. We had Garrett Margut from Directive on just a couple of weeks ago on the last episode. And he and I were chatting offline. He's like, man, anytime I post about an open role, it gets even more engagement than just kind of my normal stuff on marketing or ABM or whatever the case is. And nurturing those relationships with folks, especially at the executive level. Those are three golden nuggets from the conversation already today, Eric. I love it. All right. Well, with that, let's jump into the second P, which is really process. So being a platform where agencies really run everything when it comes to managing clients from their utilization to their projects and tasks, process is really our bread and butter here at teamwork.com. Two operating systems I've heard you mention before. One, EOS, which I've personally had some experience with. The other is scaling up. As you're talking to other agency owners, even in the group that you and Neil have recently kicked off, Eric, what are some of the things that you're pointing people to as either the pros or cons in considering maybe one of those two operating systems if they realize, hey, they need to start with some sort of process overhaul within the agency?
Yeah. So scaling up and an EOS, so Entrepreneurs Operating System. So both are great. I think if you're sub-million or doing a couple million dollars a year, then you can the book is called Traction, Entrepreneurs Operating System. There's another book called Traction. That's the one written by the DuckDuckGo founders. That's not the one. It has to say Entrepreneurs Operating System. And the thing with that is it establishes a cadence for you every single week. So let's say you're meeting on Mondays, you're talking through your rocks, which are your key goals for the quarter, right? You're talking through how are you trending towards your annual goal. And so these are things that are all good. And there's accountability. There's a feedback loop that's built into that. And then there's other meetings that can cascade from that. So we have, you know, we call it a traction meeting, right? So that's a traction meeting for the company, but we also have traction meetings for individual teams as well. And then sometimes maybe people might need to meet for like a spinoff meeting from like their internal traction meeting, that like a team traction meeting, and ends up working well because now people know there's a framework. There's certain times that they have to follow so the meeting doesn't get out of whack. And I think people like predictability, and that's what makes it easier. So whether you're using scaling up, which is almost, it's very similar to EOS. They just have different, they do things a little differently in some cases, but we also Frankenstein things from other books. So there's another book called The Great CEO Within, and that's from Matt Mosciari, right? Might be butchering his last name, but
okay.
He's a VC. He's been a successful CEO, and he has this thing called traffic lights. And so let's say, you know, Logan, you and I are responsible for getting a task done or like a goal done. We're responsible for a goal, I should say. And every single week, instead of just saying, oh, like it's going well, it's like, no, how's the goal trending? Let's say we have a sales goal. Well, you know, we didn't really close anything. Okay, great. So we have traffic lights, red, yellow, green. Green means it's going well. Yellow means it's lagging. Red means it's not going well at all. The rule that we have is if a goal is red or yellow 3 weeks in a row, we're going to stop everything and we're going to focus on that goal because that's the goal that we've set for the quarter. So what you can do is you can read different books. You can pull different frameworks that you like and then Frankenstein them together into something that works for you. And just continue to, you know, as you scale, just understand that some of these frameworks are going to break at certain points and that you might need to find another solution, but that's fine. That means you're growing.
Yeah, absolutely. As teamwork.com has scaled over the years, as you know, Peter and Dan originally were founders of a digital agency themselves before moving into the software company that we are today. And there's elements of EOS that we use, and we've even built a tool. We'll link to it in the description here, Instant Agency Tools. One of the things I really love about it, Eric, is when you're running that level 10 meeting agenda and you have the time set for the intros and the highlights and you have the time set for the issues, it keeps you on track with some of those things. So I really like the idea there, or I should say, I resonate with what you said at the end, that there are elements of even a great framework like EOS that you can pull from at different stages, but it doesn't mean you have to be married to that. But that consistency, and I think the word you used was predictability, gives you kind of a frame of reference, like what you just said there. If something's yellow 3 weeks in a row, here's what we do about it, right? Because in a service-based business where the nuances can kill you like death by 1,000 paper cuts, just putting some of those things that you don't have to think about, and you know, okay, if this happens, we do this, that frees up more mental capacity for more creativity, more problem solving. Yeah. Would you say that's kind of what you see in your experience?
Yeah, it frees up the need for people to expend even more brain power. So yes.
One of the things I've heard you talk about too, Eric, is focusing on one service and one niche to start and then expanding from there. So if we have agency owners here who really have niched down and they've kind of built their bread and butter on one service, what are some of the indicators that make it quote unquote safer? Nothing's safe these days. We don't know what's going on with the economy and the world and everything else, but to play fast and loose with that term, what are some of the markers that make it, you think, a little bit safer for an agency to test out a new service or expanding into a new vertical, those sorts of things?
Yeah. So my take on niching down in the past was, oh, that means you can only have one. But what I've learned is that you can actually have three or four. And so for us, for example, we have, sure, we work a lot of B2B SaaS, work with a lot of e-commerce, and then there's education. But there's also a handful of, there's like an increasing amount of blockchain companies too. And so for us, it's like, okay, those four are the ones that we'll sit on. Once you start to feel like you have it down with one, but then you also find that you're getting, let's say you're in B2B SaaS, you're getting more and more e-commerce, maybe you can test a couple and see how it goes. Like if you like it, then you can expand it more. But there's no sense in turning away business, especially, you know, again, it's almost like, Apple nailed their PC. Well, it's not a PC. They nailed, what was the first one? Lisa? I think they nailed that first, right? Before they started to move into different product lines. And it's the same thing for you. It's you got to nail it before you scale it.
I love that. Another area around process that I think a lot of agencies stumble on is scope creep. You know, we did a webinar several months back about over-servicing from a stat that we got in surveying over 500 agencies for our State of Agency Operations report. And I think that so many people registered for that webinar and showed up and were really going off in the comments is because this idea of over-servicing and managing scope creep, not having a process for it, really can drive a lot of folks nuts, from the agency owner all the way to the frontline employees. What are some of the things you guys have done, especially as you've scaled, to manage those sorts of things when it comes to client demands, Eric?
Yeah, for us, it's nothing too sexy. I mean, it's just, you know, if people are asking for something new, like, yeah, happy to do it. We're just going to send you this $0 change order. And so we'll send them a $0 change order and then they'll ask for it again. It's like, oh yeah, happy to do it for you. We'll send you another $0 change order. The third time that you ask for it, we'll say, happy to do it. But unfortunately, you know, we did it for free these last two times. We're going to have to charge you this time. Is that okay? And that way it's a lot more disarming saying, well, you know, I'm not comfortable with it, blah, blah, blah. It's more so like, hey, we have evidence. We have a paper trail that we did free work for you. Now it's time for you guys to pay up. And so like we gave you, like you guys used up some of your goodwill. And now it's time for you guys. Yeah, we can't just do work for free. So,
yeah, I think that does kind of put you in that middle ground of not just responding to a client and saying, well, that's not our policy or that's out of scope, because kind of that quick terse reply is going to have, you know, your agency clients feeling like they're at the DMV or something like that. But on the other side, if you just keep saying yes, you're going to have this feeling of over-servicing and the client's still not going to be happy. When you guys are doing that $0 change order and you implement this kind of third time rule, Eric, do you recommend your account managers and your team to let them know like, hey, we do two $0 change orders and then we charge on the third? Or do they just kind of introduce that on the third? I'm curious for anyone, especially managing account managers, if they're like, hey, I might want to go implement this. Any other tips on that front for them?
Yeah. So we do the second one, the latter. So it's more so, hey, like we'll just do it. We'll go with the flow. And then the third one, it's kind of like, oh, you have to pay for it. But that being said, I don't think your approach is bad. Like I think that's a good idea to just let them know up front. It's like, hey, we're going to do the $0 change order just so you know, like eventually, like we're going to have to charge for just giving them a little heads up probably would be helpful because they probably don't even know what a $0 change order means. So,
hey there, Logan with teamwork.com here with a quick timeout from today's conversation to talk about something that's always top of mind for agency leaders like you, profitability. We understand that profitability is constantly on your mind, but there's one critical part of most agencies' profitability equation that's often misinterpreted, misunderstood, or overlooked completely. Can you guess what it is? Okay, I won't make you really guess. It's billable utilization. If you don't feel like you and your team have a grasp on this key part of agency life, you can change that with a new ebook on agency billable utilization. In it, you'll learn how to define and measure billable utilization and how you stack up against 500 other agencies just like you. Plus, you can get advice from other successful agency owners on how to effectively track and measure billable utilization. You can get your copy at teamwork.com/resources or check the direct link in the description of this episode. All right, let's get back to today's conversation.
Just giving them a little heads up probably would be helpful because they probably don't even know what a $0 change order means. So
yeah, I like that though. All right, well, let's move on to the third area, which is pricing. And I've heard you say that pricing is really one of the biggest levers that you can pull in scaling an agency. And that can go a lot of different ways from raising your prices to looking at value-based pricing, pay for performance, which I want to talk to you about a little bit. But why do you think pricing is so integral and right up there with people and process in the importance in scaling an agency, Eric?
Yeah. So as an example, I mean, there are agencies out there that will charge like $100, $150 an hour for their time. Well, if you charge for your time, then you're automatically capped. And then you can say, okay, I'm going to hire more people, but also their time is capped too. Well, then you can also say, well, the biggest law firms do that. Well, yeah, they're also charging tens of thousands or thousands, if not tens of thousands per hour. And it also, when they're using multiple lawyers, that's where everything adds up. And you're starting to fork over like, you know, millions or tens of millions of dollars for like a legal bill, right? So that's a little different. So what I would say is when I think about pricing on, let's go to pricing on value, for example. So one agency might charge, you know, $2,000 a month or 15% of ad spend, whichever is higher, if they're managing like paid media, right? That's one agency. And that's a pretty standard approach. Could be anywhere from $2,000 to $5,000 or so, or 15%. Now, then another agency is going to say, hey, you know what? You don't need to pay me anything until I perform. And let's just agree on a amount that you'll pay me per customer that I drive to you. And we'll go from there. So which offer is better? Obviously the second one, because the customer, all the risk falls on the agency and the agency is only getting paid on performance. But at the same time, when an agency is getting paid on performance, they're also going to make a lot more money. So I have one friend's agency. They do about $80 million a year. $30 million of it is profit. And they only have 30 employees. And, you know, their whole thing is they only focus on one niche, right? It's what they really understand well. And like for pay for performance, you should just focus on one. It's really just affiliate marketing. You know, that seems a hell of a lot more efficient to me. So 80 million, right? Divided by 30, that's $2.6 million revenue per employee. Versus like a standard agency, maybe your revenue per employee is $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 or so. Most people just aren't willing to do that. And my whole thing is like, I've always wanted to do that. And, you know, we're moving back in that direction, right? So that's the difference, I would say. And that's why agencies tend to shoot themselves in the foot. One, they're not pricing enough. So they don't make, they're not getting what they should be paid because at the end of the day, you get what you negotiate.
Yeah, it really comes from this line I've heard from Alex Hormozi, and I'm sure you have as well. I know you've had him on your show, is delivering an offer so good that people would feel stupid saying no to, right? And when you have that tied to performance, then it makes it more of a no-brainer, or to use his words, they feel stupid saying no to it. What have been some of the things that have maybe held you guys back, or some of the things that you feel like you guys need to get in place in order to get to that place of doing more of a pay for performance offer? What are some of the things that you feel like need to be in place in order for that to work for an agency? One of you mentioned is the more narrowly you're focused, the more that this is, you're kind of de-risking a little bit. What else would you maybe add to that list?
Everything ties to the founder psyche. So in this case, it's my responsibility. And as long as I stay involved and as long as I stayed focused, there's just no way it's not going to happen. I think the problem with most agency owners is they tell themselves that an agency is a terrible business and they hate it, blah, blah, blah. But every business sucks at the end of the day. You know, as things get tougher and tougher, there's just different levels of suck, right? And I think the sooner agency owners understand that what they have in front of them is great. Like some of the biggest companies in the world are, they do billions of, like biggest agencies, I should say, in the world, they do billions in revenue. Whether it's like Accenture or like whether it's WPP, all these holding companies, Dentsu, right? And they do it in different ways. Some might do it through acquisition, but they started at like, you know, zero and then a million, then 10 million, then 100 million, then like billion, right? So why can't you do it? That's the real question. And so what I learned, like personally for me, what I learned over the years is that instead of me hating the agency and me constantly saying, oh, like I'm too good for agency, I come from tech, I'm like, no.
If I could only start a software company, right?
Yeah. Like which is what every agency owner says, right? I'm just like, you know what? No, it takes 10, 20, 30 years to build something generational. And this is the best vehicle for me, given all the work I do around my content. And I'm just going to keep doing that. And it gives me that reframe has helped me just continue versus before I was just very disgruntled all the time.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was hearing your buddy Neil talk about this recently where he was talking about, you know, he's been able to have highly profitable agencies and everybody thinks like SaaS is really where the big margins are. Agencies, like to steal the line from Tim Ferriss, like services suck. Give me a product to ship, I think was like somewhat of the paraphrase out of the 5-hour work week. And you guys have been able to do that and show that, hey, there is a great business model to be had here. What do you think has helped you guys be able to continue to charge premium prices? I mean, part of it probably has to do with the trust and the reputation and the credibility that you've built as the agency CEO over time. Do you think it's just something that a lot of agency owners don't stick with it long enough to see the margins start to grow as they scale?
Yeah. So to your last part, yeah, I just don't think people stick with it long enough. Most people can't take pain. And like, if you want to build a business, it's the best personal growth exercise. And if you're going to grow, it's going to be uncomfortable. It's going to be painful. And to your other point, I would just say, when I think about Neil has a great setup. And so when you think about Dharmesh Shah from HubSpot, and when you think about Neil, basically for them, the directive in the beginning was, I'm not going to have any direct reports and I'm just going to jump around and help with strategy. And that's worked out well. Neil knows he's a terrible people manager. I've seen it myself. And, you know, Dharmesh, I mean, they're just playing to their strengths. I think if you understand in the very beginning, you're going to put some boundaries up and you're going to play to your strengths, then great. I think, you know, for me, for example, I mentioned earlier, I'm 6% detail oriented. I've designed the organization around me to help fill those gaps. So the people that work with me very closely, they're extremely detail oriented. And so I think that's what it is, like trying to understand what your weaknesses are and then building around that and then putting those boundaries up and then also drawing a line, because people are going to constantly try to cross those boundaries. You have to keep reinforcing them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that being a part of an agency leadership team, when we read the book Traction that you were mentioning 10, 15 minutes ago, whenever it was, that visionary integrator role and realizing, oh man, our agency founder is trying to be the integrator and he's really not.
Yep.
Very similar, you know, personality type, strengths and weaknesses to you. And I think that's a common one. So I completely agree with you there. One of the other things around pricing that I've heard you say, Eric, is that not enough agencies are charging for strategy. And it reminds me of something I read on LinkedIn today from Pete Caputa, who's advised a ton of agencies in building the HubSpot partner program and now working with a lot of agencies at Databox. He called it the tactician trap, where agencies are only getting paid for the actual tactical execution. And they're not being perceived as the experts, or they're not, maybe they are, but they're not charging for that strategy. What do you think is holding a lot of agencies back there? And what do you think they can do differently?
Yeah. So the thing we do is we say, okay, we think we're not ready for execution right now. We'll say, you know, we need to move into a one-time strategy and you guys will invest some money and you guys will put some equity in there and we're going to put our sweat equity in. This gives us a chance to test drive the relationship. What you could do, say, and so you could charge, if you're like a smaller agency, you can charge a couple $1,000s for this. Good. You get a couple $1,000s. The strategy might take you a couple hours or so, or like it might take you longer. So then you might have to charge tens of thousands. But we also tell them too, if you're uncomfortable with doing it, you might say, hey, you know, we'll charge you for this, but if we end up working together, we're going to credit back to you the amount of the strategy over the course of the relationship. And that makes it easier for them to stomach, right? We did this back when we were first signing Amazon, like a very long time ago. We did this and it worked with them. Like it worked with publicly traded companies too. And so I think it comes down to you get what you negotiate thing again. I think people are uncomfortable with it. Probably most likely because It's not something they've done in the past. And I think it's being willing to test out, hey, what is the strategy going to look like? And what is that deliverable going to look like? And being willing to fail a couple times, I think that's what really sets people apart.
Absolutely. For any agency owner listening to this who is still doing that founder-led sales within the agency and you struggle with some of these negotiating points, go read Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss. Phenomenal book on negotiation and has so many applications to sales in for those in B2B tech, as well as agency owners who are selling and pitching their clients as well.
And by the way, Logan, on the founder doing the founder-led sales piece, I believe founders need to be doing sales until at least 10 million, if not more. And even like they need to be involved. I think that's the key word. I wasn't as involved as I needed to be. And again, like who am I to think that someone else is going to go out there and build my business for me? That's idiotic.
Yeah. So what has that looked like for you right now, Eric? Because are you still running that? Are you involved? What does the involvement look like? How have you done that while still maintaining those boundaries that you were talking about a few minutes ago?
Oh, right now I'm extremely involved, probably more involved than I've ever been. And so I'm looking at the product. Like I used to just focus on driving, you know, marketing and, you know, just driving people to the point of sale and then just kind of letting people do their own thing. Now I'm just across everything just to make sure we can have I can set the standards very high, and I can't do that forever. Right. I think it's right now it's like there's love Elon or hate Elon. He does this thing. So those of you that have read his recent biography, he does this thing called the surge. And the surge is when he brings people together. Like he'll say, why isn't everyone here working at SpaceX on like a Friday or whatever? It's like 9 p.m. on a Friday, right? And like, get everyone in here tomorrow, blah, blah, blah. And then everyone has to fly in tomorrow. Like they have to figure out their own living accommodations and everything. But he does that to push the pace and it riles everyone up. It gets people moving again, right? So when he starts to feel that things start to slow down, he'll do a surge. And I think he does that like, you know, maybe once or twice a year with these companies. Now I'm not saying everyone go worship Elon Musk. I'm just saying, hey, there's something you can learn from everyone. And I think I'm kind of in that surge phase right now where no, I'm not making people come in. I'm not making people work overtime or whatever, but it's more so like I'm just a lot closer to things. And then like I'll back out and then I'll come back in. I'll back out and then I'll come back in.
Yeah. And it's funny. I saw maybe it was a tweet or something saying, hey, when you guys mentioned Elon on Marketing School, you know, you get some 1-star reviews, but you know, love him or hate him, I think there's some good things to learn from him as an entrepreneur. Absolutely. And it reminds me what you were saying there. Jay Owen, who runs an agency out of Florida in the HubSpot Partner Network, has been on the show before. He was talking about work-life balance is somewhat seasonal. He's like, I'll go on sprints for a bit, right? Where my work-life balance looks very different for 2 weeks or whatever than it does in another season. And I think that can be the same for your team of, hey, there's some value in that rallying cry of like, hey, everybody's going to be super focused on this for the next 2 weeks. It's not going to be like that forever. But, you know, naturally there's some inertia that takes over and we're just like, okay, we're kind of going through the motions, and those sorts of things can be helpful. So a couple of examples there.
There's seasons for everything.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. One thing I wanted to ask you about was, you know, your journey into SaaS with ClickFlow. As we were, you know, talking about earlier, you and Neil have been, you know, prolific agency owners who have seen this model, you know, work, but there has been some tie into SaaS, but not just, hey, I'm going to use agency as a stepping stone into tech. So tell us a little bit about any lessons learned there in that venture for other agency owners that are thinking about tech as part of their journey.
Yeah, totally. So we had this SEO product called ClickFlow. And what it did initially, it was based on A/B testing titles. And then that thing kind of went away because Google just kind of chooses the titles it wants for you sometimes. And so then we made it more about we had a feature in there that will show you like where your content is dropping. And actually a good amount of people were using that. So we actually got ClickFlow to maybe about 600K in ARR. And we could have kept growing it, but we're also spending a lot of money per month on it. And it came to a decision where it's like, okay, where are we going to focus our activities? So that's one piece. It came down to a focus exercise, and it also came down to a resource allocation exercise too. And so we decided it makes sense to allocate the resources to the agency, and that it would just take, like, it's either one or the other. It's either ClickFlow or it's the agency. And so we made a decision there. And by the way, we still have the tech for ClickFlow. Like that's something that we might think about reviving in the future and just giving it away for free and use it as a lead gen tool. But I think we really had the focus at the time. And the other thing I would say is with ClickFlow, I did the thing again where I thought someone else would build my business for me. And I have no issue with the guy that was doing it. It's at the end of the day, I'm the one making the decisions, right? And I'm like, okay, like you do that. You're going to be the GM of this company and I'm going to go, you know, work on something else, right? It doesn't work like that because also he didn't get the coaching he needed from me. And so if I'm going to offload these things, what I've learned now, and if I'm going to do it in the future with these GMs and CEOs is I'm still going to be very involved. I'm going to be coaching you. I'm going to be on top of it. And, you know, people can say, oh, I'm micromanaging. No, I'm not really micromanaging. I'm just like, I just want to make sure things are moving along and you're getting what you need to succeed. That's all.
Yeah. And then going back to what we talked about earlier, having those processes in place, like your level 10 meetings or using the one-on-ones in the same structure within EOS can make those sort of feedback loops and the accountability feel less personal and more, hey, we're trying to achieve something here. We're trying to scale something. And it's that trust but verify that we started the conversation with. Well, Eric, this has been fantastic, man. We've got two final segments that we always have here on the podcast, our Fast Five and our Good Shout. So if you're good with those, let's hit you with our rapid fire round in the Agency Life Fast Five. You good?
Let's do it.
All right. Well, let's say Single Grain right now just had an extra $10,000 a month, extra $120K for the budget, no strings attached. And you could allocate that anywhere within the agency. What pops to mind first where you would use that extra budget right now?
Probably more headcount. That, or I would spend it on hiring more editors for all the work that we do. Because I would like to get us to a point where we're posting 5,000 pieces a month or so. Right now, it's like a fraction of that.
Yeah. In the content for yourself, for your agency, for your media brand, Leveling Up, you mean?
Yeah. All the short forms, the reels, like I just want 5,000 of those per month going out.
I love it, man. All right. Number two, you've already given us some great book recommendations. But what would you say is one of your all-time favorite books, especially for agency founders that you're recommending in peer groups that you're a part of, stuff like that?
Yeah, by far the most recommended book on the Leveling Up podcast over the last 10 years has been The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz.
Yep. Awesome, man. That one has been recommended here previously. So one more tally in that column for that book. All right. Number three is my favorite of the Fast Five. Eric, what's one mistake you've made in running your agency that you're never going to forget?
Not focusing.
It sounds like that's one that has, you know, reared its ugly head a time or two. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you don't really know until you really get punched in the face. And the thing is, like all the books that you read, you can't really see the statues over here, but these two statues behind me, one's Warren Buffett and one's Charlie Munger. And, you know, they're constant reminders to me to stay focused and to be patient. I mean, look how long they were patient for. And they're also very humble people too. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. I've heard, speaking of Alex Hormozi that we brought up a couple times on the show, he's saying, oh, you look at really wealthy, successful people and they're diversified. Well, no, they got very successful by focusing on one thing and not diversifying. And then they stayed wealthy by diversifying. You kind of see that, but you take it the wrong way. So good tie in there as well.
It's wealth. If you want to accumulate wealth, you focus. And then if you want to protect your wealth, you diversify.
Yeah. Yeah. Really good stuff, man. All right. Number four, what do you think is the hardest part about agency life, Eric?
People problems.
So going back to number one, people, you know, it's so critical to scaling an agency, but also the hardest part. Yeah. I love it. All right. Number five, we always end with the other side of the coin. Eric, what do you think is the best part about agency life?
I think it's very flexible. And so what I mean by that is you can make it into anything that you want. It's very malleable. And to start an agency, your capital expenditures are not high at all. And if you want to take your agency, you want to make it into a software company later, you can do that. You've seen Teamwork do it. You've seen Basecamp do it, right? And if you want to continue to have it be an agency, you want to go out there and have it become an agency holding company, you can morph it into that. And so I think it's a great business for people to start. You know, the term Andrew Wilkinson likes to use is it's a launchpad business. And I think it's a great business model and don't look down on it.
Yeah, exactly. I think your success as well as Neil's and what you guys have been able to build really is an example to look at for other agency owners or aspiring agency founders that are looking for that next level of scale. And speaking of friends and folks who have been inspiration along the way, we want to give you an opportunity to give someone a shout out who's really made an impact in your own personal journey. So who would you want to shout out today, man, as we wrap up?
Yeah, I would give a shout out to my coach, Jerry Colonna. So Tim Ferriss talks about him a lot. He's coached the CEOs of Etsy and Twilio. So he's coached me for the last 4 years or so. And there's a lot of good wisdom there. I mean, he's got a lot of range, you know, as a VC, an entrepreneur, and like a coach. And I would highly recommend anybody, you know, go look for a coach. And he has a coaching company called Reboot. You can check that out too. So
love it. Well, Eric, for anybody who's not already following a lot of your content, especially that might be valuable for a lot of your peers, other agency owners listening to this show, how would you recommend they stay connected with you or reach out if they're interested in some of the stuff you're doing for the community right now?
Yeah, so you can learn more about the group that Neil and I put together for agency owners. It's called the Agency Owners Association. So think of it as YPO or EO for agency owners, just to help everyone grow more. And we actually do live events and all that. So you can go to marketingschool.io/agency to learn more about that. Again, marketingschool.io/agency. And then you can follow me on socials at EricOSIU on Instagram or X.
I love it, man. Well, thank you so much. It's been fantastic getting to finally connect with you one-on-one. I've been a fan of Marketing School for a bit. Love what you're doing with the Leveling Up podcast. And I love how you guys are contributing to the agency community with the new stuff with the Agency Owners Association as well. Thank you so much for being our guest on Agency Life, Eric.
Thanks for having me, Logan.
You've been listening to Agency Life, and we hope you've been enjoying each and every episode. If so, you've probably got a friend who'd find the show valuable as well. Sharing a podcast with someone in your network is an easy way to add value and show someone that you're thinking about them. Somebody probably came to mind for you just now. Go ahead, shoot them a text with something like, "Hey, I've been listening to Agency Life, and I think you'd like this episode I was just listening to." They'll probably really appreciate it, and hey, we will too. And if you're looking for even more content to support your agency life journey, check out teamwork.com/agency life. There you can search through past episodes, get access to the Agency Life newsletter, and find additional video content to support and inspire you as you continue on this crazy roller coaster ride that is agency life.